We want freedom!
In Baltimore!
In Baltimore!
And when do we want it?
Now!
No justice!
No peace!
I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. As protesters prepare for more demonstrations in the streets of Baltimore, we round up the week's top news. The death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray from injuries sustained while he was in police custody. The Baltimore Sun reports today that as a child, Gray had damaging levels of lead in his blood from the house his family rented in West Baltimore. The Sun also reported that if Gray suffered his fatal injuries while handcuffed and in a police van, he would not have been the first man so injured. Mary Rose Madden of WYPR's news staff joins me, along with Baltimore City Councilman Nick Mosby. And we have open phones for listener comments on the Freddie Gray story. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday Friday, everybody. Dan Rodericks here with you. Thanks again for joining us. Now, how many of you like a nice distraction in the middle of the workday? Maybe that's why you listen to Midday. Or maybe open a new tab to see who's starting for the Orioles tonight, or you log into your Amazon account to do some shopping or some browsing. For about 8,000 Marylanders every day tuning into the Osprey Cam and the Peregrine Falcon Cam, respectively located in the Chesapeake Bay and on a downtown office tower, offer a live look into the routines of these handsome creatures, the Ospreys and the Peregrine Falcons. But perhaps few of us remember the struggle some of these birds went through decades ago. From the 1950s to the 1970s, the chemical compound DDT, used as an insecticide, did great harm to osprey populations. DDT, once ingested by birds of prey, such as the osprey and the bald eagle, leads to thinning eggshells, and many embryonic deaths occurred as a result. Later in this hour of the show, a Maryland ornithologist, Paul Spitzer, joins us to tell the story of how naturalists and the government worked together to ban DDT and ultimately save the ospreys. Though the ospreys' population has experienced an upswing, the monarch butterflies is going the other way these days, sad to say. Scientists believe herbicides used in agriculture are killing off the monarch's population. Joel Dunn of the Chesapeake Conservancy will join us to talk about the dwindling monarch butterfly population and what can be done to reverse that trend. But first, behold and beware the dreaded emerald ash borer. This beetle, the emerald ash borer, native to Asia, infests and kills ash trees. In Baltimore, there are nearly 300,000 ash trees, representing 10% of the total tree population. It is the city's most common tree. In Maryland, only Baltimore and Harford counties have been spared the ash borer so far. Our guest is Mike Raup, an entomologist and professor from the University of Maryland. He's also the author of the Bug of the Week blog, which I've just discovered and I found delightful. You can read the blog at bugoftheweek.com, and we'll tell you about an event that's happening at the University of Maryland with bugs tomorrow. But first, Mike Raup, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you on the show.
Well, Dan, it's great to be here, and I'd rather talk about monarchs than this emerald ash borer. I got to tell you, I'm not sure we can save our ashes in this case. This is going to be a nasty one.
It's bad, and I've read reports that said the emerald ash borer is here to stay.
It is here to stay. It was first detected out around Detroit, Michigan in 2002. It probably came in as early as maybe 1995, and we got our first case of this thing in 2003 with an illegal shipment of ash trees from Michigan to Prince George's County. It's now spread throughout much of the country. I believe it's in 25 states, and it's simply not going to be one that we can put the brakes on, unfortunately.
It is a, I would say, a beautiful creature. Just, I mean, based on the color of it,
gorgeous,
it is beautiful.
Bug.
And that you can find a photograph of it on my Facebook page. We've tweeted out pictures of it. I mean, it is stunning looking, but
beautiful but deadly.
Yeah, and it didn't fly here from Asia.
No, unfortunately, you know, Dan, right now we've got a global economy, and what this is going to translate into is a global biota. So every year we simply get more and more pests from foreign countries. Such a small proportion of these containers that come from foreign lands ever get inspected. We believe this one came over in packing material inside one of these cargo containers, shipped down through the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, bam, it lands in Detroit, Michigan. Somebody opens up that container and out flies the beetle. And now it's Katie bar the door. Here we go.
What does the emerald ash borer actually do to ash trees?
Well, the reason this one is so lethal, remember the gypsy moth and the problems?
Sure.
Well, that one kind of nibbled leaves. Okay, that takes a certain toll on the trees, but we can control that pretty easily. Those trees can refoliate. This one goes right after the heart of the tree. Any tree adds its girth. The way a tree gets bigger is a specialized tissue we call the cambium. That's the heart of the tree. This one feeds in the cambium, that nutrient-rich tissue. It girdles the tree, it kills the tree, and bam, that tree is dead within 3 to 5 years.
Does it do this in big numbers, or is the emerald ash borer efficient? It can work on its own pretty well.
It needs to have pretty big numbers, but we can have densities up to maybe as many as 90 per square meter of bark. So these trees, big ash trees, are simply generating literally thousands or perhaps maybe tens of thousands of these beetles that then will move off and attack other nearby trees.
Ash trees are beautiful trees. I grew up around ash trees, and they're used for baseball bats. So you could call this the baseball bat killing bug.
And trust me, the Louisville Slugger Company that used to grow their ash trees along a ridgetop over in Pennsylvania was very concerned about this particular borer, and it has now moved into Pennsylvania. I'm not exactly sure what the Louisville Slugger guys did, but I have a suspicion that they may have harvested the stock wood that they used for those baseball bats. And I'm guessing that stuff is stockpiled somewhere now, safely down in Kentucky somewhere.
Well, let's talk about where it is in the
Sure.
United States. You mentioned Michigan. It's throughout the Midwest, and it's
throughout
come east.
Throughout the Midwest, it's come east. It's as far south now as Louisiana. It's into Colorado. It's into New York, basically centered east and west of the Mississippi. And there's really no reason, Dan, to expect that this one isn't going to hit every one of the lower 48.
I mentioned that so far Baltimore County has been spared. We had a story in The Sun saying that,
right.
But I guess that won't last very long.
They won't last very long, and I think in a lot of cases what happens is we simply haven't detected it yet. I personally would be very surprised were it not in Baltimore County as we speak. Sometimes it takes a little while to detect this thing, but the real problem with it is detection is difficult when it's at very low levels. Let's talk for a minute about how we might detect it, how a homeowner might see this. First of all, you're going to see thinning in the canopy of your ash tree. In other words, there'll be a place up in the top of that tree that just doesn't have a nice dense cavity, a canopy, a leaf cover. But the real clue here is going to be woodpeckers. Woodpeckers have spent tens of millions of years figuring out how to find this thing and eat it. So when you start to see woodpeckers work in your ash tree, a big light should go on. That's a big flag that you need to have a closer look for this thing. And that's usually a pretty good indicator that you might have an infested ash tree.
Okay. Once you establish that, then what can you do?
Well, there's a couple things you can do. Homeowners, there are good products on the market, which both homeowners, but even our professional arborists, and we have a very, very well-trained and skilled, technically proficient crew of certified arborists right here in Maryland that have the tools and the techniques to be able to arrest this problem, to stop it dead in its track, as long as not too much of that ash canopy has been lost. So if the trees maybe have lost 10, 20, 30% of that canopy, that thing can be shut down and that tree can be saved.
Mike Rupp, entomologist, joining us in this segment of the show from the University of Maryland. If you have a quick question for Mike, please give us a ring. 410-662-8780 is our number. Not enough birds.
Yeah, really.
People will say,
really.
You know, if we had more birds, but could we?
Well, we're gonna have a lot more woodpeckers. Let me tell you that.
Really?
Because this baby has killed. We put the number somewhere north of 100 million trees in North America already, And there's a population here in North America of somewhere around 8 billion ash trees. So this is an ecological catastrophe that, frankly, is well underway. Cities in the Midwest that have had this problem since the 2000s have simply lost their entire ash canopy. And municipal budgets, instead of buying books and buses for kids and paying teachers, those municipal budgets went to taking down dead ash trees.
Let's take a quick call from Mike Raup. Stu in Cedarcroft in Baltimore, thanks for calling.
Hey, Dan, how are you today?
Okay, I'm a little concerned about what I'm hearing here from Mike, though.
Well, we moved here from Columbus, Ohio 3 years ago, and I don't think people in Baltimore or in Maryland understand how completely catastrophic this little tiny pretty green bug is. On our old block where we used to live, I helped the city pick out new street trees for it probably about 20 years ago. Last year, every single ash tree on a two-block area was stripped out.
Wow.
And what's so insidious about this little bug is you look at the tree and it looks fine to you, but it gets in through a little hole, the larvae get in there, and they essentially, as your guest said, they eat the vascular system with these serpentine tunnels, and it's a slow, painful death for the tree, but the bug can be moved so easily. So in Ohio, one of the things that they laid down was don't move firewood from one jurisdiction to the other, and that really, it slowed it down, but it really didn't help. There's no way to stop this bug, and it's going to be a real ecological loss for the area.
Yes, Stu, you're absolutely right. When we first saw this come into Prince George's County, down around Brandywine, that's where we got this infestation back in 2003 with an illegal shipment of ash trees that came out of a quarantine zone in Michigan. We were measuring rate of spread, and it was moving only about a mile a year. We had a projection. We created three models, and we proposed that it would take about 30 years to move from Brandywine into Baltimore. Unfortunately, you hit the nail on the head. People move firewood. That's how this baby spread so quickly. We jumped out of Prince George's County up to Howard and Anne Arundel, and now it's Katy bar the door. We got it here in the city. So it's the human assist that allows this particular beast to move so rapidly. That's been the history of the pest throughout the Midwest. And unfortunately, that history repeats itself now here in Maryland.
Here's another call. Seth in Baltimore. Question for Mike Raup.
Hi. We have a couple of ash trees on our property, and our tree service has recommended that we do a preventative spray for the trees. And my concern is that the chemicals that they want to use would be harmful to the bee population and other beneficial insects. And what is the thought on, saving the ash tree or letting it go in favor of the safety of the rest of the insect population?
These are excellent points, Seth, and these are things we need to be concerned about and should be concerned about. So number one, the chemicals hopefully that your arborist is going to apply are actually systemic chemicals. The best approach for this and the approach that's been recommended and widely used out in the Midwest is the use of injections directly into your tree, so you're not exposing insects, birds, other creatures that are in the canopy of that tree to these particular insecticides. A much better approach than what we would call a wet spray that goes up over the top. So hopefully your arborist is going to use one of these systemic products. Point number two here is these products, and the one we prefer, the active ingredient is called emamectin benzoate. This is probably going to give at least 2 and perhaps 3 years of protection for that particular ash tree. Now, in the development of the biology of this particular pest, once it moves into an area, let's say a city, we will double the amount of tree loss in about every year. So we're going to go from 2% to 4% to 8 to 16%. And within a span of 8 to 10 years, we go to 100% tree loss. This is like a great tsunami rolling over a city. Once those trees are dead at about year five, then the beetle populations start to collapse because there are no longer trees available for it to use.
Mike, I want to ask you this in the time that we have remaining together on the story of the emerald ash borer. It's native to Asia.
Yes.
So does that mean there are no ash trees left in Asia? I want to ask you this, though. So this is a unnatural thing that occurred because of our actions, humans' actions, ships, cargo containers.
Yep.
This is the way modern commerce works, right? And
it is.
And it brings along these creatures. So we're looking at a North America potentially without ash trees?
And to the point, what we always have to do here, Seth, is we have to weigh the relative risk of these compounds to the loss of 8 billion ash trees. It's not just the 8 billion ash trees. There are more than 24 other species of creatures intimately associated with ash. So if these 12 species of ash go down the toilet, so too go these other 24 species. So this is a catastrophe of epic proportions. Now, the other piece to your point, Dan, is remember the ash trees, the Asian ash trees, have spent 60 million years duking it out with this beetle. They know how to beat it. So the Asian ashes are resistant. It's just like the situation we had with American chestnut blight and Dutch elm disease.
Yep.
If there's no coevolutionary history between the tree and the pathogen or the pest, once that pest gets over here, it says, "Welcome to America. I'm going to eat you to death." And that's exactly the situation we have right now.
One last question while Mike Raup is with us. Stephen in Baltimore, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. I'm glad you brought up the elm situation. Has that blight stopped? And lastly, how much does it cost to actually treat an ash tree?
Great questions. The chestnut blight or Dutch elm disease.
He asked about elm.
Okay, the Dutch elm disease basically continues to roll through the Midwest. Here it's kind of settled down because the populations of the beetle that vector it have generally declined because there are fewer elm trees. So this is what happens. Once it takes out the trees, then this situation starts to stabilize, and we have a much better handle on how to manage this particular pathogen and insect that carries it than we did 30 years ago when this first started. How much does it cost to treat an ash tree? Well, that's going to vary on the number of ash trees you have to treat. In the big cities out in the Midwest, it might cost as much as maybe $40 or $50 per, the way we calculate this is per inch of diameter breast height. We call it inch per dBH. But once you're treating a large number of trees, that price is going to drop dramatically. And that's what makes it more effective very often to treat your trees rather than cut them down.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for being here today. Mike Raup, entomologist from the University of Maryland. I also want to mention that the Department of Entomology is hosting an insect petting zoo. It's tomorrow. Tomorrow
it is.
At College Park. There's information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, along with Mike Raup's Bug of the Week blog. Thank you very much for being here, Mike.
A real pleasure, Dan.
Yeah, okay. And you might want to take the kids to the insect petting zoo down at College Park tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That wraps it up with Mike, but then we're going to move on to our next subject here. Joel Dunn will be joining us, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Conservancy, to talk about the monarch butterfly and why we aren't seeing quite so many of these as we used to. Please stay with us. It's Midday Friday. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Again, the piano in the background there, there's Robin Spielberg, who's been a guest on our show here, as she's performing tonight in Little Italy, 7 p.m. at Germano's Piattini. Can you remember the last time you saw a monarch butterfly? For many, the answer might be no. When they're around, they're hard to miss. They have beautiful large wings with orange and black patterns. Here in Maryland, they're one of the signs to tell us it's finally spring again. Joining me now, Joel Dunn. Joel Dunn, back on the show, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Conservancy, and he's here to tell us more about why we don't see as many monarchs as we used to. We got onto this subject a little bit the last time you were on the show, Joel. Nice to have you back with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So have you seen one, by the way?
I haven't this year. I saw one last year.
I saw a cluster of them in western Maryland a couple of autumns ago. I think it was autumn. I think it was late summer, maybe September. But I haven't seen them around Baltimore, and so that's not unusual for us not to see them.
No, that tracks national trends, that there's a severe decline in monarch butterfly populations across the country. We've actually seen a drop from a billion in 1997, a billion monarch butterflies, down to about 56 million last winter in North America. So that's a huge drop.
How are they tracked, by the way? How is that done? Do you know?
Well, primarily biologists go to their wintering grounds because all of the monarch butterflies flock together down in Oyamel, Mexico, and they will cover the trees, these conifer trees down in Mexico. So biologists can get a pretty good count of how many are there.
Why? Why is this happening?
A variety of things are happening. I mean, first, let me say, you know, I'm a person who loves nature, outdoors, discovery. I spent my childhood outside, so, you know, finding snakes and butterflies is a passion of mine. I'm concerned about endangered species across the world, and protecting and preserving them is something that inspires me. And so the monarch butterfly, the plight of the monarch butterfly is something that really concerns me. The major causes are loss of habitat, climate change, and weather changes, and the application of pesticides and herbicides. The big one, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, is the application of glyphosate or Roundup, which people apply to farm fields and kills milkweed. See, milkweed decreases crop yields, and so farmers very reasonably want to get the most out of their land, and so Roundup is particularly effective at killing milkweed and increasing yields. So companies like Monsanto and others have developed genetically modified Roundup-tolerant crops. So 94% of soybean crops these days and over 70% of corn crops are Roundup-ready, meaning that you can apply Roundup to the fields. It won't harm the soybeans or the corn, but it'll get rid of all the weeds. And milkweed is a huge resource for monarchs. They depend upon it to fuel their migration and their reproduction. So it also is important to wasps, bees, moths, other pollinators, which have similarly to monarchs seen huge declines over the last decade, which is very concerning for many reasons.
A farmer here in Maryland or anywhere, the problem with milkweed is that it just takes up too much space. If
right.
you let it go, you got to control it.
That's right.
And it will pop up in the midst of crops as well.
That's
right. Unless you control it. Okay. So has Monsanto, I know that I've seen stories about Monsanto being presented with this problem. What does Monsanto actually say about the monarch problem?
They acknowledge that there is a monarch butterfly issue. They actually recently committed $4 million to addressing some of the conservation efforts to match what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has pledged to create monarch habitat. Their goal is to plant milkweed wherever possible to try and boost up the population. You see, these butterflies are really, really amazing. They migrate from Mexico to Canada in six generations. You see, so it's not the one butterfly leaves Mexico and five generations later, one will fly all the way back from Canada to Mexico. I mean, what a miraculous thing.
It's an amazing thing. And here we are, human beings messing with that. You know,
well, and this just tracks with what we've been seeing globally.
Yeah, yeah. So the other two pieces of that, loss of habitat and the weather. Can we talk about that just for a minute? So loss of habitat. That doesn't just mean loss of milkweed. That's loss of habitat, meaning
the forests in Mexico where they winter. They've been significantly reduced from deforestation, fragmentation of the habitat up and down the East Coast, highways, developments, you name it. That has big impacts on wildlife that migrate in particular. And when we think about landscapes from Canada to Mexico or in the Chesapeake from Cooperstown to Virginia Beach, on a landscape scale like that, we can more effectively manage for the species we care about. It's almost a crime to future generations for us to not think about protecting species like this. I was chewing my cereal this morning thinking about it, And I said, man, what would it be like if I saw a Carolina parakeet outside my window right now? But I can't see that Carolina parakeet because they disappeared from this planet in 1930 because we didn't appropriately manage for that species. Deforestation and hunting eradicated it from this earth. So those colors will never influence my imagination. And I'm my fiance is going to have a baby in a week. So my kid will never have the opportunity to see a Carolina parakeet. I don't want to rob future generations of the opportunity to see monarch butterflies. So I'm really interested in building partnerships and awareness with all sectors of the economy to try and fix this issue and others affecting species and ecosystems.
Are the monarchs listed as an endangered species? Are we there yet?
They're not listed yet, but biologists have petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the monarch butterfly as a threatened species, and the Natural Resources Defense Council has sued the EPA to consider the dangers of Roundup to monarchs. See, there's other chemicals that the EPA regulates, like DDT, which caused impacts for birds of prey, which I know you're going to talk about in a minute here. Mm-hmm. Similarly, EPA has a responsibility to regulate chemicals and their impact on other species in the ecosystem.
How impressed are you with Monsanto's response to this?
There's
what do you say personally and others in the conservation community?
Well, I'll say that I really appreciate when a corporation takes responsibility and pitches into the effort to protect the environment. So there are lots of companies out there like DuPont, for example, that has done remarkable things to improve their environmental performance and to fix some of the things that they messed up in the past. So I'd say the $4 million is a step in the right direction, but there's a lot more I think Monsanto and other companies could do to address this problem and others in the environment.
We're speaking with Joel Dunn from the Chesapeake Conservancy about monarch butterflies and their dwindling populations. Would you say 1 billion or so in the mid-90s, 1997, to some 50 million or so now?
That's right.
Let's take a call on this. Daniel in Frederick, you're on Midday Friday. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm definitely on board. A couple years ago, I started growing milkweed down in my basement rather than my peppers. And last year I had two little patches, four in one patch and five in another. And I got them out real early because, well, I've got some now. They're about 8 inches tall. And they're just about ready to set out. And it was really cool. I was home last year, and I saw monarchs land on my milkweed, the orange and yellow ones, whichever one they are, and go ahead and deposit their eggs, or I think that's what they were doing. And they did, because sometime later, I had my first little brood of chrysalises and after the caterpillars, then I had my monarchs, and I actually had one of them crawling up and down my arm, and it took off. It was wonderful. Then the second brood, and the whole routine again, and this is what I'd like to talk about, is the second brood, unfortunately, were attacked by what I think I found out were some kind of a parasitic wasp that laid its eggs inside the chrysalis and killed pretty much all the second brood, which broke my heart. So this time I'm doing the same thing again. I'm going to have my little patches, but this time I'm going to try to go out and pick the chrysalises off and put them in. I'm planning on finding an abandoned fish tank and put some wire mesh on top and leave it either inside or outside.
Daniel.
Let them hatch that way.
I like this phone call. I like this idea. I'm sitting here getting depressed thinking about monarch butterflies. Because my question to Joel Dunn was going to be, besides writing letters to Monsanto and members of Congress and the EPA, what can we do? And here's Daniel. By the way, Daniel, did you mail away for those seeds?
Yeah, the first year, I just got on the computer, and there's somebody that you can buy the plants from or you can buy the seeds from. And I don't know how many different types of milkweed there are. It gets into all the names, and whichever mine is like has a beautiful orange and yellow flower, and it stays. It flowers all summer long. Oh,
thank you very much, Daniel. Yeah. I'm glad you called in. I think Joel has more information about this. Go ahead,
yeah,
Joel.
I think that's great. Yeah. I mean, what a great way to get in touch with nature and to do your part to try and bring the monarchs back. So there's 73 native milkweed species in the U.S. The one in Maryland that I think Daniel was referring to was probably the common milkweed, and it can be a little tricky to grow. I heard that he grew it inside, which is probably the easier way to get it started. But there's several local milkweed providers, and there's a couple nonprofits that provide kits for folks to grow milkweed in their garden so that they have a native flora and fauna that supports the local ecosystem. So Monarch Watch is a group that sells these kits, and you just Google them, and you can find them. And then I have some information that I can provide to you, Dan, if there's other
We could post it. Is it posted on your website, the Chesapeake Conservancy?
Yeah, there's some information on there, and then I'll give it to you as well.
Okay. And I just drove by a state park and saw a sign that said native plant sale coming up on May 9th. It's possible milkweed would be included in that.
That's possible. I'm glad you brought up local and state parks because you know, species like the monarch and whether you're talking about eagles or ospreys or falcons or whatnot, all depend upon parks to sustain their populations. It's also a place, of course, for your personal spiritual connection with nature. But, you know, funding for state parks, federal funding for parks is essential to protect species like this and others for current and future generations.
Can you stay with us, Joel, for the next segment?
Sure.
Joel Dunn, because we're going to talk about ospreys as we move on from monarchs, or at least with that hopeful note there at the end that you can do something about this. I'm going to look into getting some milkweed seed now. And I appreciate that call from Daniel and Frederick. If others of you have questions, 410-662-8780. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about the osprey, the return of the osprey. So this is a promising story, isn't it? This is the ascendancy of the osprey, once a threatened species, now very common in Maryland. And we're going to talk about that with Paul Spitzer, who is a osprey expert naturalist, will be joining us on the phone from Connecticut, but he lives here in Maryland.
And it's a great example of what environmental conservation can achieve when we set our minds to it and when we identify a problem and work together to solve it.
Yep. And if you have a question or comment about anything we've discussed so far on the show, the monarchs or the emerald ash borer, 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. Want to take a quick call here on the monarchs before we move on to our discussion of the ospreys, the monarch butterflies. Patricia in Annapolis giving us a ring. Hello, Patricia. Go right ahead. Hi.
Hi, Dan. I just wanted to report up some positive news, as I told your screener. I've lived in Annapolis for 15 years, and I've had a rather sizable monarch and bumblebee population since I've lived here. I don't do any pesticides or herbicides at all on my lawn or my shrubs. I do have butterfly bushes, and the monarchs seem to really favor my white butterfly bush.
How do you like
and
that?
And my bumblebees are all over the yard.
I think it's wonderful. And, I mean, Patricia, when you see those butterflies, that feeling you get, the way it colors makes life so much more colorful, it's so worth it. I think it's great that you have an environment in your yard that's suitable for them. And thanks for sharing the good news with us that you've seen some in Annapolis.
Yep. Thank you very much, Patricia. That's Joel Dunn from the Chesapeake Conservancy. Joel, you're familiar with Tom and Audrey, right? Tom and Audrey from the Eastern Shore?
That's right. That's our famous osprey couple. We have a live camera on them all the time.
I want to tell people about this. If you're not already aware of it, the Chesapeake Conservancy has the osprey cam. I just checked it a little while ago, and I guess that's Tom. I guess that's Audrey that I would be seeing sitting on the nest.
They take turns.
Yeah. Okay. Tom and Audrey. So you can take a look at that. You can go to the Facebook page, Dan Roderick's Facebook page, or ChesapeakeConservancy.org, and go to the osprey cam. Tom and Audrey, they spend the winter in South America, right?
Yeah, and they split up. They go to different places in South America.
Oh, they take separate vacations?
Yeah, and then they reunite in the Chesapeake right around St. Patrick's Day, and they have a lot of love for that particular nesting site.
The Chesapeake Conservancy also opened up a live stream of a peregrine falcon pair on a downtown office tower in Baltimore. And you're getting, what, 8,000 views a day between the two, the Osprey Cam and the Peregrine Falcon Cam?
Yeah, from about 100 countries from around the world. And our whole goal with these cams is to share the magic in nature with the public, to connect them with the Chesapeake Bay and the ecosystem so that they drive demand for conservation and that they enjoy it as much as we do.
Well, in this hour of Midday Friday that we're devoting to the topic of human impact on the natural world, you know, the sort of collateral damage that we've caused over the years, here's a story of, I guess, repairing the damage. It might be hard to imagine that only a few decades ago, a world without osprey was a possibility because of the chemical compound DDT. DDT was used as an insecticide for humans. And although it was not harmful to us, when ingested by osprey or other birds like that, including the bald eagle, it thinned their eggs, leaving many of them broken or infertile. So joining our conversation now is osprey expert Paul Spitzer. He's a naturalist and ornithologist. He lives in Trapp, Maryland. We're speaking to him today from Connecticut, and he's been studying ospreys for more than three decades. It's nice to have you on the show, Paul Spitzer. Thank you for joining us.
Hi Dan. Good to be here. Hi, Joel. I hope it's a good connection.
Yeah, well,
it's great.
Yeah, you sound fine. So,
well, that's good.
Overall, how bad did it get for ospreys, and how good is it now?
Well, it wasn't as bad on the Chesapeake as it was up here. There was more concentrated DDT in the ecosystem. Up here, it went down to about 10% of their former numbers. In the Chesapeake, we didn't have previous data, so we're not so sure, but they did go way down, and now it's a triumph. They're way up. They're doing extremely well all over the bay, and really anyone who wants to see ospreys, if you come down to the bay and poke around a bit, you'll find an osprey nest, and you may be surprised where you find it because they're very tolerant of people. Just so long as people tolerate them, they build on water towers and the lights at baseball fields. Anything's possible.
Well, they don't seem to be shy about building a nest where they want to build a nest.
Yes, it can be a bit much sometimes, but by and large, both people and ospreys seem to go down the road together very happily.
By the way, Joel, excuse me, where is the osprey nest?
It's on Kent Island.
Kent Island,
just across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge.
That's where Tom and Audrey are.
That's right. Yeah. And they're great ambassadors for the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, they're what you're going to see when you go kayaking out on the John Smith Trail, or when you go to a state park, or when you go to your friend's house that has waterfront.
How many eggs will a female lay at a given time, and how many broods could they have? Do they only have one brood per year? Or do they do?
Yeah, that's right. It's all they can do to manage. It's a big deal producing more ospreys, and literally they'll be laying their eggs back in earlier in April, and those young won't be flying until July, and they still feed the young for a while. So. They have one shot at it every year, and they typically lay three eggs. And when the food regime is good and the birds are good, old, experienced birds, they often fledge two or three young.
You know, I quickly summarized the DDT story, and I haven't mentioned the name Rachel Carson in this. And you can't talk about DDT without mentioning Rachel Carson, who was a Marylander, and Silent Spring. So, Paul, if you don't mind, for those who need a refresher course on what happened here with DDT and birds of prey, please go over that.
Well, sure. We were in a situation coming into the 1960s where people really weren't paying very much attention to the damage that we were doing to the environment. And Rachel Carson, with her book Silent Spring, was one of the people who sounded the call. It was a brave book in that all the data was by no means in, and she got out in front and sort of connected the dots. And then for a whole decade afterwards, there were scientists like myself. I was a graduate student, a young scientist at that point, who documented the theories, the hypotheses that she had put forward. And that was a great advance in environmental toxicology. In 1972, DDT was banned by the federal government, and that was under the newly formed EPA, which was formed during the Nixon administration. And so there was a great turnabout, a great understanding that we had far more responsibility for stewardship than we had been willing to acknowledge up till then.
And as far as food supply goes for the osprey and seeing this population flourish and grow even further, what's the prognosis there, Paul?
I think the prognosis is good. It's obviously that there are now many thousands of nests around the bay, and that wouldn't be possible if the food wasn't out there. We are using ospreys as a biomonitor of the abundance of menhaden. Menhaden are front and center as a management issue right now. There's going to be a meeting about that in early May. And actually, that's why I'm up in Connecticut, because the older menhaden migrate up to here in May, and I'm working on using a famous osprey colony or two up here to monitor the abundance of menhaden and make sure that the fish are managed in a way that leaves enough of them in the water to perform their many ecological functions. So ospreys continue to have a value as a biomonitor. This is a totally different story. That was a pesticide, a contaminant story. This is a straight ecology and food story. But the value of the ospreys, because we know them so well and they're so widespread, the value of the ospreys for science and for environmental protection is very much there.
Here's my quick osprey story. Fishing one day and getting skunked, spending 4 or 5 hours trying to catch trout and being unable to do this, and deciding to leave at the end of the day, you know, happy to have gone fishing, but, you know, disappointed I didn't catch one fish. And then I look up and overhead, coming down the river, is an osprey, beautiful bird, and in its talons, 15-16 inch brown trout that had eluded me all day. So there, and he flew right over my head. Maybe 30 feet over my head.
Imagine what life would be like if you didn't see that.
Yeah, I know. I was very happy about it.
Dr. Spitzer, didn't you play a key role in the restoration of the osprey down here? Tell us that story.
Well, I'm actually back in my home grounds here now, although I've lived on the Eastern Shore off and on for 30 years. And my first big glimpse of Chesapeake Bay was during that DDT era. The Maryland eggs were still hatching substantially better than the ones up here because they were far less contaminated with DDT. There was some element. They were about a 60% hatch, and now they'd be back up near 100%. At any rate, through working with the Fish and Wildlife Service, we flew a bunch of freshly laid eggs up to here. We did an egg switch, and we were able to demonstrate that the problem lay within the egg. That is, the Maryland eggs hatched at their usual fairly good rate up here. The Connecticut eggs, which we transported south, hatched at their usual terrible rate of, maybe 10% or so at that point down in Maryland. So, yeah, that plus some other things. I was very much, that was my coming of age as a biologist, thanks to people like Rachel Carson and Roger Torrey Peterson. Rachel, the book came out in 62, and Rachel was already ill, and she passed away in 65. So other people picked up the baton, and one of them was my mentor, Roger Torrey Peterson, famous for his the bird books. He was also a very fine ecologist before the term ecologist was really very current. And this isn't well known, but he had big innings in Maryland, too. For many years, he lived over in Glen Echo, and he worked with the Audubon Naturalist Society in Chevy Chase. They have their headquarters up there on Jones Mill Road. It's a great place for your readers to go to learn about conservation. They have the best natural history and ecology bookstore maybe on the whole East Coast. So I'm delighted to be able to put in a plug for the Audubon Naturalist Society.
That's fine, Paul.
On Jones Mill Road.
Paul Spitzer, I had one more question for you about ospreys, and then Clem from Gardenville is calling in with a question for the ornithologist. My question, I'm not sure we cover this, is how long can ospreys live if they live a full natural life?
Well, it's not like human beings in that, of course, there are no hospital services, et cetera. So the answer is that once they reach maturity at about 3 years, it tends to be a constant mortality out till about the late teens, maybe age 15, 16. And that constant mortality might be 10% a year or a little higher than that from all of the perils that they face on migration and such. And then there are a few geriatric ospreys out there. The mortality rate jumps up, and just a handful of ospreys make it into their 20s.
All right. Thank you, Paul. And a question from Clem in Gardenville for our ornithologist on the phone. Go right ahead, Clem.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Let's see. Back in the early 1990s, I was living in the 1700 block of St. Paul Street in downtown Baltimore, working in the restaurant industry and rarely getting home before maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And right before dawn, there were lots of abandoned buildings all around me. I would hear and observe lots of owls who would be returning to their homes in these abandoned buildings after apparently hunting mice and rats there in Baltimore City.
Yep.
So apparently these large predator bird species, you know, actually managed to thrive in this kind of environment.
Yes, that's true. There are quite a few cases of that, and both Washington and Baltimore have enough habitat. Well, you mentioned one kind of habitat. Washington, and I suppose sections of Baltimore, are enough garden cities that all kinds of birds spread right through the city, that the birds from the northern forest in the winter can occur really all around town. I've seen northern hawks hunting on the mall rather commonly, and the little winter wren is in. I've seen winter wrens. They seem to like the National Zoo very much. So we live in pretty birdie country, and that element of that ability of animals and birds in particular to adapt to the human presence is something to be very grateful for.
Hey, speaking of owls, Paul, before I let you go, I finally heard a barred owl. I somehow I missed this. And I couldn't identify it right away, but I had numerous people tell me, because I recorded the sound and shared it with them, they said, oh, that's a barred owl. That's who cooks for you. Who cooks
that's
for
right.
you? That's how
yeah.
you remember. That's what the barred owl. Did you know that, Joel?
Yeah, I did.
Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you? It was great. Thank you very much for being on the show, Paul.
My pleasure,
yep.
Dan. Best,
yep.
Joel.
Yep.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for your work on the osprey. Hey, before we close out the show here, try to get a couple of quick calls in. Jim in Bel Air, a science teacher, with a quick question about a quick comment about the monarch butterflies. Go right ahead, Jim.
Hey, how are you? My
Good.
Name is Jim Pritchard. I'm a teacher at Southampton Middle School in Harford County. And we have a courtyard at our school that was in really terrible condition. The principal gave me permission to redo the entire thing with my students in native plants. So we're actually doing the other courtyard right now, but 4 years ago we planted milkweed along with lots of other native plants to show people how beautiful native plants can be. And this past fall, we had a lot of monarch butterflies that came and hatched out in our courtyard, and some of the kids got a chance to put them on their nose while the wings were blowing up, and it was really cool. A lot of really great connections between eighth graders and nature.
Hey, Jim, how did you plant the milkweed?
Well, we got them. They were already plants. We bought them at, can I tell you the name of the native plant dealer?
Yeah, sure. Quick.
It's Kohler Nursery. Stan Kohler came, and he put them in our courtyard with us, And he gave us a whole bunch of plants. We got about $2,000 worth of plants from him.
Did you say Kohler Nursery?
Kohler, K-O-L-L-A-R.
Where are they located, in Harford County?
They're in Harford County, up in northern Harford County.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for that story, too. I'm glad the kids got to see the monarch butterflies. Joel Dunn, thanks for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks
yeah,
so much.
So some good news. So take a look at the osprey cam, which we have up on our screen now. Is that... That's Audrey there?
That's right, ChesapeakeConservancy.org.
How do you know that's Audrey, not Tom? You can
She's
just tell?
She's got certain markings on the top of her
okay,
head.
Okay, all right. Take a look at that, folks, and also the peregrine falcon cam as well from the Chesapeake Conservancy, Joel Dunn. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for tuning in, everybody, all week long here on Midday. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.